Hi, this is Marietta Daily Journal podcast host Darren Sutherland. We hope you're having a fabulous holiday season. Cobb Life staff is off this weekend, but we wanted to replay one of the most listened to Cobb Life podcasts of 2020. Thanks, host and Cobb Life editor Katie Ruth, for doing such a great job with these every Sundays. We'll be back next week with a brand new edition of Cobb Life. Now, sit back and enjoy The Killing in Cobb County, a story you won't soon forget. Happy holidays from your friends at the Cobb Life and Marietta Daily Journal podcast.
Why do you think bank presidents and jewelry store owners trust ADT to protect their homes and businesses? Because they feel safe, and you can too. How would you like to monitor your home from fire, floods, and yes, robberies without even being there right from your smartphone? That is peace of mind. You may even save money on your homeowner's insurance just by having an ADT system installed. And there's even a money-back guarantee. How about that? We guarantee 100% satisfaction. You have nothing to risk. Why do you think people who have so much to protect trust ADT? Because it works. Call right now for a free quote. We'll even give you a free gift for calling. So pick up your phone and call Protect Your Home, an ADT authorized premier provider now.
800-584-2518. 800-584-2518. 800-584-2518. That's 800-584-2518.
It pays to know your doctor. It pays to know your lawyer. And more than ever, to know your local real estate professional. Hi, I'm Glenn Drake with Drake Realty, with 7 offices in Metro Atlanta, including 2 right here in Cobb County. I'm the proud leader of over 700 agents here in Georgia. Drake Realty makes the home buying process seamless from contract to close. Our agents are a little different. They're not pushing for the quick sale and close. They're pushing for the best price and terms for their clients. In other words, Drake Realty fights for you. And right now, with the lowest interest rates that we've seen in 30 years, now's the time to buy that dream home, vacation home, upgrade, downsize, or a new home your family deserves. A lot of real estate agents talk big. Let my team at Drake Realty prove they will fight for you. I'm Glenn Drake, and I'd be honored to have my team serve you. Visit us online at drakerealty.com. And remember, it's not how quick you sell or buy, it's how the deal sets up your future.
This is Amy Cargas, co-host of the MDJ podcast. Make sure you subscribe and join Darren Sutherland and me every Tuesday, Thursday, and Saturday for hyper-local news and information about Marietta, Cobb, and surrounding areas. Tell your friends and never miss an episode of the Marietta Daily Journal podcast. Now here's Katie Ruth.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Sunday Cobb Life podcast. This is Cobb Life editor Katie Ruth Camp, and we've got something a little different for today, but still something I think will be of high interest to everyone. I have the Cobb County Deputy Chief Assistant District Attorney Jesse Evans here with me today. He is also the head of the Major Crimes, Homicide, and Cold Case Units. So welcome,
Jesse. Good morning.
So I'm sure if I don't scare you off today, hopefully I can have you back and we can talk about a lot of things, because I know there's a lot of interesting murder trials that you've prosecuted and covered, and cold case, which we were just talking about before this, that the trial that we're going to talk about today was kind of a springboard for a lot of cold cases.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So, but today we are going to talk about the murder trial of Carmen Smith. Her 5-year-old son, Nick, was also stabbed, I believe, 18 times.
Correct.
But luckily lived and survived and made it through that. But for those who are unfamiliar with the case, maybe haven't seen the Dateline episode or haven't read any of the media coverage, take us kind of step by step with what happened in this case.
Sure. This case started in 1995, specifically October 23rd, 1995, is when Carmen was brutally murdered in her own home. So well before my career with the DA's office, I've been with the DA's office, it'll be 20 years in January. But even when I started with the DA's office, I was familiar with this case because it was pretty sensational at the time. Basically, Carmen was discovered murdered in her own home. She had been there for a good period of time with her killer, the defendant that we ultimately convicted. And one of the sensational aspects of the case is that there were some children that were involved in the case as well, including Carmen's son, Nick Smith, who was stabbed 18 times. And he was only 5 years old at the time. Miraculously, he survived his injuries and actually testified at his mom's future trial, which I handled in 2012. So the case, as with many cold cases, is you start off and you think, hey, this case is going to be solved relatively quickly. And credit to Cobb County Police Department for all the excellent work that they did in investigating the case back then. Very early on, the defendant in the case, an individual named Wasim Dacre, became the focus of attention because he had been terrorizing a housemate of Carmen even before this woman moved into the house that Carmen lived at.
And Carmen and her son Nick lived on like the lower level of the house, right?
Correct.
Like a basement level?
Correct.
Is what it seemed like?
This house was in East Cobb, really nice neighborhood, a little bit older home, but it was broken up into basically two parts and was being rented out. So upstairs was a woman named Lottie and her daughter, and then downstairs, Carmen, she lived down there with her son Nick. So it was a situation where you had two single moms that were living together. They weren't roommates specifically, though, because the house was kind of broken up.
Gotcha.
So anyway, when police got called to the scene, they initially were called out because of the stabbing of Nick. There was a babysitter there and her boyfriend. And when Nick got stabbed, a portion of that was witnessed by Lottie's daughter, who was downstairs at the time.
Because if I remember correctly, Lottie's daughter and Nick had gotten off the school bus, right? And his mom's car was there, so they thought that she was there. But when he came downstairs, Lottie's daughter actually stayed back, but Nick was that's when Nick was stabbed by the person who we find out later murdered his mom before that.
Correct. So the timeline specifically for that date is that Lottie, the upstairs housemate, she went off to work. And per usual, the kids, Christina and Nick, they rode the same bus to the same elementary school. So they left in the morning. Everybody was gone by 7:30 with the exception of Carmen. So this was a Monday morning, and she she was a flight attendant, but she didn't have a flight that day. So she was just kind of remaining at the house. And ultimately, the perpetrator broke into the home, ended up killing her. It was a unique homicide. We don't get a lot of ligature strangulation homicides, but she had some very distinct injuries to her. She had been, it looked like, bound up and probably with handcuffs, it appears. She had some injuries on her wrist consistent with having struggled against some handcuffs. She had two superficial puncture wounds to her back. They were non-life-threatening, but like somebody was controlling her. And the cause and manner of death, it was a homicide, but the specific mechanism of death was she died of ligature strangulation. You put like a rope around her neck, and clearly he probably was on top of her because she had some fiber on her chin and an abrasion there, sort of like she was struggling against the ligature, and probably got a carpet burn to her chin. Because this guy was so obsessed with the housemate, he actually remained in the crime scene for a good period of time. So we could tell and presented forensically the fact that she was placed in her bed, was covered up with bedding. She was only partially clothed at that point. Her pants had been pulled down. Her panties were pulled down a little bit too. She was cold to the touch, and she had something called lividity, which is where you have pooling of the blood. And because of that, forensically, we can tell that she was probably killed in the morning, but he stayed in the house throughout the day.
So, right, because if Nick got off the school bus, I mean, that would have been late afternoon.
Absolutely.
So he was there the whole time.
Sure. Yeah, wow. Absolutely. Which is really telling for us, as I'll get into as we talk about the investigation. But Nick and Christina, they got off the school bus as usual. It's about 2:50 in the afternoon. And initially they saw that Carmen's car was there. So they expected that she was home, which would be common. And they went inside to try to find her. They went downstairs to the basement area where they lived. And Nick was calling for his mom and didn't get a response initially. So because of that, they went back upstairs. Now, you should know the Friday beforehand, the perpetrator in this case had called the home. and had specifically called the person upstairs, which was contrary to a court order that says he was to have no contact with her. And then after that, he actually called Carmen's phone as well, and she disclosed before her death that this stalker that had been stalking her upstairs housemate had actually made contact with her and that she was fearful of this whole scenario that was going on. So mm-hmm. by the day of the murder, people were already aware that there was a situation that was brewing between this guy and the upstairs housemate. And the kids knew about it too. They were present that Friday mm-hmm. When the phone calls happened. So when they didn't get a response from Carmen when they were downstairs, that's why they got a little bit alarmed and ended up going up to Christina's room for a little bit. Not very long, but just for a little bit.
Mm-hmm. And didn't I think I remember, too, Carmen actually kept a hammer beside her bed just in case something were to happen, you know, because obviously she was in fear of something potentially happening.
She did. Yeah. When she disclosed to family members that this sort of scary situation from the Friday before, mm-hmm. They urged her and asked her if she wanted to any weapons to kind of protect herself. And she did start keeping a hammer under the bed as well. So, you know, I think everybody was on edge about what was going on with this terrifying behavior of this mm-hmm. guy that had persisted for, you know, basically a year before the housemate moved into this home where right. Carmen was staying.
Let's get into talking about the guy, because the guy is convicted of murder for this case, Wasim Dacre. How does he come into this situation?
So Wasim Dacre started off in a relationship of some sorts, and there's been a lot of discussions about what the nature of that mm-hmm. relationship was over the years. But basically through paintball, which is pretty popular back then, and the woman, the housemate, Lottie, upstairs, she was significantly older than him.
And she was 30 and he was 17 at the time, I think
that's correct. Yeah.
Isn't illegal, but it's a little creepy.
Yeah. So, I mean, there's always been questions about the full nature of that relationship. Certainly I posed right. the questions to her through the years, and up to and through the trial, she claimed that it was just, you know, non-romantic. She has since changed that story and said that it was, which from our perspective doesn't really matter, as I've told her. Our case was about what happened to Carmen and not so much involving her. It was mm-hmm. more, that was more the background information, if that makes sense, mm-hmm. for why this perpetrator would choose this home of all homes and why he would do what he did. But he engaged in a campaign of pretty terrifying things, stalking, harassing, breaking into Lottie's home. It was all documented by Fulton County Police Department.
And at one point, she said that she came home one day and he was in her bedroom just wearing like garter hose and standing in front of her mirror. Like, oh my gosh, that's like a woman's worst nightmare to come in and see something like that, you know.
Correct. She did share with us, and she did, in fact, tell the jury that this behavior was certainly escalating. It got to the point where after several arrests down in Fulton County, there were conditions of bond and a protective order that basically said, hey, Dacre, you need to stay away from her. You know.
So she was calling the police on him.
She was. And in fact, there was even at some point there was a brief car chase where a Fulton County police officer was in the home when he was making phone calls. He got on the phone with him. It was actually recorded. He recorded it, and we recovered that recording.
Wow, I heard that.
So the officer, yeah, he thought, well, listen, he's probably calling. At that point in time, cell phones weren't very popular, so he was right. probably calling from a payphone. Mm-hmm. That's what they suspected. And using good police instincts, he went to try to catch him and actually saw him drive by in a vehicle that was kind of on the radar. And there was a short car chase. Fortunately, nobody was hurt or anything like that. And he was actually identified and arrested then. It was one of several arrests out of Fulton County. So this was all well documented. There was a detective involved with it as well. Mm-hmm. That he had, I would call it nothing less than a campaign of terror that he was waging against her. Now, the question as to why that was occurring, that's always been a source of debate. Mm-hmm. And he certainly made claims back at the time that they were in some sort of relationship, and that he said a lot of disparaging things about her and the nature of their relationship with each other.
Mm-hmm.
So that's sort of the background for why Carmen's home and why mm-hmm. He might break into this house. He had been breaking into Lottie's home before she moved to Cobb.
She moved to get away from him, right? Or to try to.
She did, yeah. She actually moved in September of 1995, so she hadn't been in the home very long. Mm-hmm. In fact, one of the interesting aspects of our case is initially when it was revealed that he might be a suspect because of this terrifying behavior that was going on, police went and spoke to him. They spoke to him by the early morning hours of October 24th, 1995, and he denied ever being at the house or knowing where it was. Well, eventually they obtained a search warrant for his house, and they actually found a handwritten note where he had written down the address and written down the phone number. So despite his denials and even during his interview, he sort of denied at first that he knew where it was, and then he got confronted with some things and ultimately he had to admit, okay, well, you know, I knew what the address was, but I didn't know where she was.
And hadn't he written a letter to Lottie that they also found during that search, basically saying, like, I'm going to get revenge on you, but I'm not going to kill you?
There were a couple of letters that we presented, and one of them was just chilling. It was actually, I'll refer to it as the torn up letter. So there was one mm-hmm. intact letter, and there was one that was torn up. In the intact letter, he talks about his obsessions and just being needing to work on obsession and things like that. It's almost like journaling is mm-hmm. what I would call it. He claimed that he was writing to a psychiatrist that he was ordered to see by Fulton County Courts, but I would call it more journaling. And then the torn-up letter is really chilling. He actually talks about revenge, talks about the fact that revenge is what kept him going in jail, and specifically says, you know, what kept me going in jail is plotting to destroy her, not kill her, though I will let her live. So he's referring to Lottie and talking about some plan and foolproof plans. He actually mentions that about mm-hmm. Extracting revenge on her, but also as if he's some puppet master, being able to allow her to live but send a message to her as well.
Which essentially is what he did.
Sure. Yeah, this is one of the first sexually motivated homicide cases that I prosecuted. A lot of people ask, well, you know, is there evidence of actual sex acts that were perpetrated? That was investigated, and we just can't say. Mm-hmm. There certainly was no forensic evidence of sexual intercourse or anything like that. Though her pants were pulled down, her panties when she was rolled over were below the waistline. Her shirt had been pushed up just below her bra area, mm-hmm. and her bra had been fastened in a way that was like a teenager would do. Certainly, it was not fastened like right. she had done it herself. So it looks like she was purposefully undressed and redressed. So we investigated as a sexually motivated homicide, and rightfully so. And what we learned, I learned quite a bit about this case from the experts, is there's a term called displacement, which is a lot of these obsessive homicidal offenders displace their anger on other people to exact revenge on the target of their frustration. So it's just a fascinating case to look at in terms of some of the research that's out there, primarily from the Behavioral Analysis Unit of the FBI,
right,
regarding sexually motivated homicidal offenders and obsessive killings.
So some people might be wondering, this murder happened in 95, but the trial wasn't till 2012. But I know at the time in 95, DNA evidence still wasn't as good as it is now or as it was in 2012. And at the time, you guys thought that it was him, but there just wasn't enough evidence to take him to trial. But there certainly was enough evidence to send him to jail for stalking. Right.
Precisely. And, you know, this is a good case example when it comes to cold cases of the fact that we never quit. Mm-hmm. And we never gave up on this case. He was interviewed back then. It was a long interview, as I recall, it was about 3 hours long, by detectives with Cobb County Police. He made some admissions about some of his behavior, but ultimately denied that he was involved in the murder itself, and claimed that he had never been inside that home, which is really important for us. Mm-hmm. So we had that recorded interview from back then. happened in 1995. And you're correct, Katie Ruth, that basically my predecessors who were involved in the investigation of this case, like I said before, I came to the DA's office, they correctly and wisely made a strategic decision that, hey, we can't prosecute him for murder right now, but we think we have enough evidence to prosecute him for the felonies, aggravated stalking, for the phone calls that were placed to the house from the Thursday, the Friday before. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, that's what happened. He was went on trial for several phone calls that were placed to the home in violation of a court order. That's a felony under the laws of the state of Georgia. It's called aggravated stalking. Mm-hmm. So he had a jury trial in 1996. He was convicted on both of those counts. He got the maximum sentence. He went to prison for 10 years, or I think two consecutive counts of 5 years at the time. That's mm-hmm. what the sentencing range was. And we continued to work on
it. Did Lottie testify during those trials?
She
about
did.
About the stalking and everything? Yeah.
Yeah, she actually testified in that first trial. There are transcripts of it. So, you know, a lot of the things that I'm recounting to you now about what happened were well documented in 1995 and 1996, not only in the police file, but there's also court records as well mm-hmm. From this pretty sensational trial for the stalking case. And then we just never gave up on the case. So the most notable evidence, the case was solved ultimately with advances in DNA science.
Mm-hmm.
And back then, there was not a whole lot that we could do with hair evidence, for example. So this was, you know, late 80s going into the early 90s was sort of the beginning of forensic DNA science. And mm-hmm. It was becoming more commonplace for us to be able to do things with blood evidence, with semen, with secretions, with things like that. But we couldn't do a whole lot with hair.
Mm-hmm.
So back at the time, there were, in particular, two notable hairs that were recovered from Carmen, one on her abdomen, and then one was underneath the shirt, just below the bra line. And she was specifically, as I think I mentioned, under some covers in her own bed. She had been placed there mm-hmm. and sort of hidden from view. So under layers of bedding and then under her clothing was one hair that ended up being the most important one. But there were a couple of hairs that we recovered. Back then, we would place them on slides so that trace and analysts with the Georgia Bureau of Investigations could do some microscopic comparisons.
Mm-hmm.
And all they could say is these appear to be limb hairs and they didn't come from her. So we knew that she had foreign hairs on her. We just couldn't say much more than that because there wasn't the advances that we have today.
Right. So you had the evidence, but at the time, nothing was conclusive. You couldn't really get anything from the evidence.
Correct. And there was a prosecutor in my office, and credit to him, he went to a conference and he had known about the case. We all kind of knew about the case. You can't work at the Cobb DA's office and not think about this sort of sensational happening in 1995. And he heard about some advances in DNA science and DNA technology. And beginning around 2005, we said, hey, let's go back and see, do we still have this hair evidence? And sure enough, we were able to find that we still had the slides. There were quite a few slides that still had the preserved hair.
Yeah.
If you think of your old biology and chemistry classes in high school and college,
right.
You think about those clear glass slides where they put just a little bit of glue on the edge and they preserved the hair there. Fortunately for us, we still had that evidence and we were interested in seeing if we could do some advanced forensic analysis. So the first thing we did is we went to the FBI and said, hey, do you have an approved lab that's doing what we call mitochondrial DNA?
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't have the most utility in the world, but it's a step. And they approved some advanced testing through the Arizona Department of Public Safety. They had a special lab there that was approved by the FBI. So first step was to send the slides out there. They looked at one of the slides and one of the limb hairs from the abdomen, and they released their results, which are consistent with him being the donor of it. Unfortunately, the way it reads, because it's mitochondrial, is cannot be excluded as the donor, but it also can't exclude other people in his maternal bloodline, which is why I say of some utility. So it, mm-hmm. it said, yeah, he's a potential donor, but so would some of his relatives as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he did have siblings, which made things challenging from back then, if that makes sense.
Mm-hmm.
But as advances in DNA continued, we learned that it's possible to do a nuclear DNA analysis on some hairs where they have root material. So the next step was around 2009, we asked Arizona to take a look at those slides. They still had mm-hmm. them and say, hey, just, you know, let us know, are you seeing anything? When you look at it, do you see any hairs that potentially have roots? And they called back and said, yeah, we think there's a real potential here for nuclear DNA. And we're talking nucleus of cells. That's why they call it nuclear DNA. So our then cold case detective with Cobb County Police Department, he later was hired by the DA's office to lead our cold case unit. John Dawes, he flew out to Arizona, picked up the evidence. We hired an advanced private lab in Texas called Orchid Cellmark and had those slides delivered to them and said, hey, listen, take a look at this hair. Particularly, we're interested in the hair that was recovered off of Carmen. And let us know whether you could do any of this advanced DNA testing.
Because her hair was like – she was like a strawberry blonde, but the hair that you found on her was dark.
Right? Exactly. And in fact, one of the pieces of evidence that we presented at trial was a photograph of Mr. Dacre that was taken October 24th of 95 when police first had contact with him. And they had to wake him up, so he was basically sitting on a couch in his boxer shorts. And I loved that photo for our trial because it showed that he was – I mean, he had a lot of dark hair and a lot of dark body hair. And you're correct. Carmen was beautiful. She was very fair complected. She had, I would call it strawberry blonde hair. And clearly you could look at this hair evidence and say, well, this doesn't belong here. So we were very fortunate. In 2009, our private lab from Texas called us and said, hey, we've got results. And we have the known DNA sample of your perpetrator. We've compared it to some nuclear DNA samples that were recovered from the root of this hair that was underneath her shirt, underneath the bra line, basically, and we have a DNA match. So we were really excited about that. We now were able to advance our murder case. There isn't a statute of limitations for murder. We began the next steps of trying to figure out, well, where he is. By this time, he was out of prison. He had served his prison time. He remained in the metro Atlanta area. So we began an operation to try to find him and try to pick him up and see if we can capitalize on finding some other evidence, particularly digital evidence that might be a benefit to us.
Well, because back when they had interviewed him before, he had said he had never been in the house. So obviously having his hair there not only puts him in the house, but on her body, you know, it's not just that there just happened to be hair in the house. I mean, that was under her shirt.
Precisely. The location of the hair was particularly telling. You know, say what you will about him. His denial that he was in the home is one thing. But to have his actual hair on a person that was a stranger to him, I mean, that was sort of it for him. That was the evidence that we needed to advance our case and take him to trial event finally.
How did you get his DNA? Because I'm always interested, you know, you hear about these different trials or cold cases, and you know, sometimes it's like they have to like kind of track them down and watch them as they drink at a Waffle House and then go back and steal the cup, you know, because they won't give their DNA.
Sure. We call that surreptitious DNA collection. And, and we sometimes have to resort to that. It's not the ideal method of getting DNA. It's better if you can go directly to him, which is what happened in this case. So we obtained known DNA samples from back then thinking, hey, if something comes back on the sex assault kit or if some of this other stuff that we're looking at reveals the presence of DNA, perhaps we can do a match back then. And then to add to it, while he was in prison and before he got out, our lead detective went down to the prison system with a search warrant and executed an additional search warrant on him to try to get a known DNA sample. So that was accomplished around 2005, just before, right around the time that we're starting to do the hair analysis.
Right.
So we had the benefit of having known profiles from him as early as 95, but continuing up through 2005.
So you've got a DNA match. That's got to be, you know, for a prosecutor, that's got to be a huge feeling of just a big win, especially with a cold case like this.
It was so exciting for us. You know, we always want to be able to get accountability and bring some semblance of justice to victims' families. And got to be rough. It is rough. We hear horrible stories all the time from family members that are suffering because they've lost a loved one to homicide. It's hard enough when the offender is caught right then, right there, and you have to wait for the trial. For me, I can't even imagine what it must have been like for Carmen's family, and in particular for Nick. He grew up without his mom. Lost her in the most devastating way possible. And it was a remarkably rewarding experience to be able to sit down with him at the the Cobb County Courthouse and talk about the trial and talk about the prospects and talk about his testimony and talk to the family members about the fact that because we didn't quit, because of the hard work of Cobb Police and those teammates on my office, that we were able to get to that point where we could finally say, hey, we've got enough to arrest the perpetrator.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to take a quick break, but when we come back, we're going to talk about the trial. Obviously, as we've already said, he was convicted, but during the trial, there was plenty of drama then, and then there's been a huge twist since then, too. So we'll be back with Jesse Evans.
During difficult times, it can help to talk to a friend or neighbor. But once in a while, you need a lawyer. You need Atlanta's caring lawyers, Cawthorn, Knorr, and Owen. If you're considering ending your marriage, struggling with a stressful job situation, dealing with a devastating personal injury, or facing end-of-life issues, the team at Cawthorn, Knorr, and Owen is here for you. The Cawthorn, Knorr, and Owen team has been serving Marietta and Metro Atlanta since 1972. They believe that getting the best possible outcome for their clients begins with energetic and dedicated preparation. From starting a new business to planning an estate, Cawthorn, Knorr, and Owen have the experience to guide you through some of life's most challenging legal issues. So, the next time you need a cup of sugar or a ride to work, go ahead and call your next-door neighbor. But for the important life issues, turn to the experts, Cawthorn, Knorr, and Owen. To schedule an information session or case evaluation session, call 770-528-0150. That's 770-528-0150. Cawthorn, Knorr, and Owen, Atlanta's caring lawyers. You deserve better than your bank. Better service, better rates, better solutions. If you live or work in Cobb County, now is the perfect time to make the switch to the Credit Union of Georgia, the better way to bank. Since 1960, Credit Union of Georgia has been providing Northwest Georgia with financial solutions that make sense for your home, business, and family. As a homegrown, not-for-profit cooperative, our members are our mission. Not only will you get the best loan rates, you'll get personalized customer service from people who understand your needs. Plus, Credit Union of Georgia provides real convenience with a network of more than 30,000 accessible ATMs and branch locations across the country. Of course, there's also 5 locations right here in Cobb County. Ready to see how much better your banking can be with Credit Union of Georgia? Become a member today or apply for a loan online by visiting www.cuofga.org. Credit Union of Georgia, the better way to bank.
Okay, we are back with Jesse Evans, and Jesse has been talking to us about the murder trial of the murder of Carmen Smith. And Wasim Dacre is the convicted murderer in this case. But kind of talk us through the trial, because you kind of had some surprises levied at you during that trial, even though you had the DNA evidence, starting off with him deciding to represent himself.
Absolutely. There were a lot of twists and turns with this case, not only in the investigation and the lead up to the arrest in 2010, but once he was arrested, then the drama continued. He's sort of a dramatic character, for lack of a better term. He's not dumb. I mean, at the age of 16, he was duly enrolled at his high school in Georgia Tech as well. So he was a smart guy. He had done internships with the Cobb County Medical Examiner's Office and had talked to counselors about wanting to be an assassin and a CIA agent and things like that. So he was an unusual defendant in that a lot of the defendants that I deal with, they all come from different backgrounds, but he actually came from a background where he had some level of intelligence and he knew enough about the court system from his first trial and from navigating through appeals and things like that based on his first conviction that he knew just enough to be dangerous.
Yeah. What does it say to you when a defendant decides to defend themselves and not obtain a lawyer, because you can get a lawyer for free too. It doesn't mean that they don't have the money, so they have to do that. You know, they choose to do that. But are you always surprised, or are you thinking like, oh, this makes things a little easier for me?
So for murder cases, it's unusual that a person would represent themselves. But you do have an absolute right. There's some case law out there that says if you choose to represent yourself, then you can. You also have a right to an attorney, as I think all of your listeners and you would know. You know, it's not a good idea. A lot of people make the mistake, though, of thinking, well, this must be easier for the state to prosecute somebody when the person has chosen to represent themselves. ourselves. We actually find the opposite to be true because jurors have a tendency to try to feel sorry for the defendant a little bit if you are too aggressive with them. So we get to a point where we as prosecutors have to think about strategically, how are we handling this case and how are we handling the prosecution? So I certainly didn't want him to represent himself. He fired several attorneys. He initially hired an attorney, fired him. He had an appointed attorney. He tried to fire him. There were more appointed attorneys. Eventually, he fired them. We were going to have a trial with him representing himself. And at the last minute, just before jury selection, he made a promise to the court, the judge that was handling the case at that time. Well, listen, if you give my attorney some more time, I'll agree to allow them to remain on the case. So he got a continuance sort of over objection, but it wasn't a bad thing because we actually I'd prefer to try a case against skilled practitioners who know the rules versus somebody who might try to skirt the rules, which is what we had with him. Despite his promise to the court, when we got in trial in front of Judge Mary Staley Clark, after conducting jury selection, the defendant stood up and basically said, hey, I choose to represent myself. I want to do an opening statement. Needless to say, the court was upset. Not upset, like angry, but, you know, was concerned about the decision-making process, as was the state. We sort of took a night to research it and figure out what our positions were. By the next morning, he had done enough research that he could articulate to the court why he thought it was a good idea for him to represent himself. So on the one hand,
what was his reasoning?
You know, I'm not sure that he would ever tell you what it was. For us legally to be able to allow somebody to represent themselves, all that we need to do is, as a threshold matter, make sure that they understand the process, minimums, maximums, the consequences, those kind of things. But there's never a requirement that you give your specific rationale. Now, I'll tell you, you know, on the one hand, one might say, well, it's a bad thing to represent yourself. I tend to agree with that. I think it's always good to have a lawyer if you're a criminal defendant, particularly going on trial for a murder. On the other hand, something that was maybe smart on his part is when he got to opening and closing, he was talking to the jury directly and not subjecting himself to cross-examination. So from a strategic standpoint, he was able to talk to his peers that were going to be judging the case against him, right? Without the benefit of me being able to attack what he was asserting.
Poke holes in what he was saying.
Absolutely. So I don't know that that's the case, but I suspect that probably he was thinking from a strategic standpoint on his part that maybe this was an opportunity for him to try to convince the jury that we got the wrong guy or that the DNA science was no good. Without having to allow us to delve into that through an aggressive cross-examination.
Right, right. So he goes to trial. He's representing himself. Lottie actually testifies in that about the stalking. And I know she has said in the past that she was actually the one who went to police when Carmen was murdered and said, I think I know who did this, and kind of started on that trail with Wasim. So she testifies then. Ultimately, he's convicted. And I think I read, too, where he refused to sign the documents for his sentencing.
That's my recollection. There's a requirement that you do that. But, you know, he's a very difficult defendant. And when sentencing did come after he was convicted, he did not want to sign certain documents, and which is his prerogative. It doesn't change anything, though. His signature is not required when a court imposes a sentence on him. Yeah, that was the process. And, you know, interesting fact that I know a lot of people like to talk about Lottie. She was sort of the background for the murder. She was the explanation of why this guy, this sociopath, would be focused on this house in the first place. But this case was never about her. In fact, your listeners may not know this, but we made the decision to arrest and prosecute before we even talked to her. This case was going to go forward with or without her. And we actually had quite a few discussions about whether we even wanted to call her to the stand or whether we would just do it without her, because it really was about the DNA science and about the other forensic evidence that we found. But nonetheless, we felt that we wanted to at least explain that backdrop, at least, you know, kind of frame up why this person, why this defendant would be at the house in the first place. So we elected to call her. It was not without some hesitation. She testified that she knew him. She testified about the stalking behavior that I told you about. She denied having any relationship with him, any romantic relationship or anything like that. And I think the sensational thing that people look at now is since then she's been in contact with him. There have been a lot of letters written back and forth between them, and he ultimately convinced her that she needs to change her story. So she tried to do that, tried to change her story. She submitted some filed affidavits where she said, well, it's not true. I really did have a relationship with him and those kind of things.
So did you have some red flags from the beginning? Because I know you said you guys even thought maybe we won't even have her on stand. Did you have some thoughts that maybe she wasn't being truthful about everything that she was telling you, or what? Because it seems like you were already a little bit apprehensive about her.
Sure. She definitely had some issues, definitely had some baggage, for lack of a better term. And mm-hmm. we were aware of that. And my very first phone conversation with her was a call when he was arrested, just to let her know, hey, this is who I am, and this is why I'm calling you, and I want to let you know that an arrest has been made. But all of that was in process before we even reached out and spoke to her. Mm-hmm. And it kind of is maybe a sign for you all that this case was really not about her.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, candidly, when I look at the case file, I look at the prior trial, I look at some of the things, a lot of questions about, hey, you're an older woman, there's this younger teenage kid, what's really going on here? Why is it that he's suddenly become so obsessed in stalking mm-hmm. you? I certainly asked her every which way but Sunday about the nature of their relationship, and all but encouraged her to make sure she was completely truthful with us. But I can't say, I even said in closing argument to the jury,
yeah.
whether or not she had a relationship with him really doesn't matter.
Right.
And you don't have to make a finding about that, ladies and gentlemen of the jury, because it's really not about her.
Mm-hmm.
But sure, I think it's accurate to say that we as objective investigators certainly had questions and did pose those questions to her about the nature of the relationship.
Mm-hmm. And back then, you know, she was saying he was, you know, your worst nightmare. He's like the villain in a horror movie. I mean, she was basically saying, like, this guy was very much capable of murdering someone. Fast forward a few years later, she's taken like a second mortgage out on her house. She's put him in her life insurance policy to pay for all his legal fees. And I know in his appeal, which he was denied, you visually came into the trial with a box of letters that from him in prison to her and her writing him back of all this correspondence that they've had since then. So it almost, do you think that he has been manipulating her into changing her story, or to thinking that he actually was innocent?
There's no doubt about it. When you look at the banker's box of letters that we collected pursuant to search warrant, you can see a progression of him intentionally manipulating her. And he's all about domination, manipulation, and control.
Mm-hmm.
It's one thing for her to say that there was this campaign of stalking against her. Okay, that's one thing. It's another thing to go back and say, well, is that corroborated? And multiple witnesses, civilians saw it, neighbors saw it, friends of hers were with her when these things were going on, police reports document it. So she called the police. Police arrested him multiple times
right.
prior to the murder for this. So those things did happen. There's no doubt about it. The question is, why did they happen? And that's the big question, I guess, that
mm-hmm.
We just have lingering out there. At one point, she says, I didn't have a romantic relationship. She now says that she did. Though if you dig a little deeper, you can see also that he's clearly manipulating her. He even drafted the affidavits that he sent to her for her signature. And
oh, wow.
There's even a letter that she wrote to him that basically says, why don't you just fill out the affidavits? You're better with this stuff than I am. And it had her signature on it. So, yeah, there's definitely a campaign of manipulation that continued not only beginning in 95
mm-hmm.
through the trial up through 2012, but even into the appeals process and for the motion for new trial as well. And probably persists today. I'd be surprised if they are not still in contact with each other.
Mm-hmm. And I know one of her arguments for the hair evidence being on Carmen is that she and Lottie and Wasim had used these blankets that she then gave to Carmen, I guess, like a couple of days before she was murdered. And she's saying that's why his hair was found on her. But I know you contested that and said, okay, what did these blankets look like? You know, how old were they? Where did you get them from? You know, and she couldn't really remember any specifics at all about these blankets.
Right. I think I would say alleged blankets because clearly by this point, she has not been truthful about a lot of things. We did ask her about her mental health and, you know, she was a victim too. So we did offer victim services and she was listed in the indictment as well because of the stalking type issues that were going on with her. So, you know, I wanted to be respectful of the fact that she had admittedly been through an ordeal. Again, the cause of that ordeal is what we're really talking about now. But when we really pried a little deeper into, hey, you're now claiming blankets for the first time in, you know, 20 something years, tell us more about it. She could not. And we just don't think it's true. And even if it was, the idea that there could have been this mysterious transfer of hair, not only from a blanket to Carmen, the exact location of the hair is really, really telling. So you start off with Carmen laying on her back, partially nude, one hair on her abdomen, one hair underneath a white shirt that's pushed up to the bra line, right? Mm-hmm. And then you pull bedding over the top of her as well. We're talking layers upon layers and of her own bedding on her own bed. It just doesn't make sense that that hair would supernaturally be there. And I think that's maybe the best word for it as we get close to Halloween.
Yeah, yeah. Because it really is it's about this time 25 years ago when the murder occurred, right? It was late October.
Yeah, sure. So, I was looking at some of the crime scene photos in advance of this. You know, I remember the case like it was yesterday. It's just one of those gripping, ripped from the headline kind of cases that you'll never forget. But I remember looking at that back sliding door on the house and seeing that there's actually a little skeleton, one of those hanging paper skeletons there on the sliding door because Nick and Carmen had clearly been getting ready for Halloween, which is just about a week away. Mm-hmm. It's very, very sad that he wasn't able to celebrate, have a good time of Halloween with his mom because of what this violent offender did to him and his family.
Yeah. So obviously, you know, there are appeals still happening. But to you, is this over? I mean, did you find the right guy, the right guys in jail?
100%. This is the perpetrator of this crime. Nobody else was involved in it. DNA science solved this case with good, hard police work. Fortunately, Cobb police had the foresight to collect that hair evidence back then. That is the evidence in the case. There's no doubt that we got the right offender and we got the right results in this case because of the good, hard police work and the tenacity of the Cobb County Police Department. Detectives and my team that we just never give up on these. So we were so glad to be able to give Nick an opportunity to come and testify and get some accountability for him. Finally, he graduated from University of Georgia.
Went
on to be a Bulldog. And, you know, we're still in contact with him. I was able to see him. He's actually a keynote speaker at a local charity event. And we got to attend that and support him for Live Safe, which does a lot for our community.
Right.
He's probably one of the most remarkable aspects of the story, just to see how well he's done since all of this.
Well, because at the end of the day, obviously, there's a dynamic convicted murderer. There's all these other things at play. But at the end of the day, this was about Carmen, and this was about solving her murder and finding the person that did something so brutal to her and taking and to Nick. I mean, thankfully he was able to survive those 18 stab wounds, but you know, the wounds continue because he had to grow up without his mother, essentially.
We're very proud of the hard work that we were able to put into this case, and it starts with Cobb County Police Department and just how dedicated those professionals are. But one of the things that's frustrating from my perspective as the prosecutor is that so much is lost on the actual evidence because of this craziness that's gone on in the background involving Lottie. And it's never been about her. It's always been she's always been sort of the backdrop, the explanation for why this happened. This case always needed to be about Carmen and Nick. Mm-hmm. And I'm glad that you're giving listeners an opportunity to hear some of this evidence, such as the fact that there was a knife blade that was recovered from the scene that matched the brand of knives that was at the defendant's house back in 95. There's so many little things that are out there that tend to corroborate the DNA science, which is unrefuted at the trial. And I'm glad that we're able to share some of this stuff with the general public, because I do think that they hear some of the sensational post conviction aspects of it, and they want to take something away from what the case was really about, which has always been Carmen and Nick.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much for joining me today, Jesse. And I know there's many, many other interesting cases you worked on. Hopefully, maybe we can get you back in here to talk about some of those. A few of which I actually covered as Mr. Brumby called me a cub reporter. A lot of murder trials that you prosecuted that I wrote about and covered as well. So maybe we can have you back in and talk about some more of these.
I'd love to. It's been an absolute pleasure today.
Thank you for joining me for the Cobb Life edition of the Marietta Daily Journal podcast from your local news source, the Marietta Daily Journal and MDJ Online. Be sure to pick up a copy of this month's Cobb Life magazine and visit us online for more complete details on the stories we've discussed, plus more stories that affect you and the people of Cobb and surrounding areas. Subscribe and share this podcast to get all the latest hyperlocal updates, plus great stories about what makes living in Cobb so special. Or ask Alexa or Google Home to play the Marietta Daily Journal podcast for you. Share your thoughts or questions with us in the comments section or call the MDJ podcast comment line at 404-997-8655. We might even share your comment on an upcoming episode. The MDJ podcast is produced by BG Ad Group, Amy Cargus, producer, Jacob Sutherland, director. Copyright 2020, all rights reserved.
This podcast is brought to you in part by AM 920 The Answer, Atlanta's home for news, opinion, and insight. Just go to am920theanswer.com to listen live. That's am920theanswer.com.
Looking for a way to find out what's going on in your neighborhood and across the North Atlanta suburbs? Now you can get the hyperlocal news you need anytime. In Cobb County, check out the Marietta Daily Journal podcast. Live a bit farther east, then the North Fulton Neighbor podcast has you covered. And Gwinnett County folks, be sure to listen to the Gwinnett Daily Post podcast. We didn't forget our friends in Cherokee County. The Cherokee Tribune Ledger News podcast has all your local news, too. You can find these podcasts wherever you get your podcasts. So subscribe and share the only hyperlocal news podcast for your area. Brought to you by the BG Podcast Network.
Joyette Holmes for Cobb County District Attorney.
My parents would be at the local grocery stores educating and collecting money for sickle cell research or doing fish fries to sell plates to help get school supplies for kids in our community. So I knew that I had to serve in whatever work I decided to do. It didn't matter that I was a defense attorney for a public defender's office or in my private law firm or an assistant prosecutor in the solicitor or DA's office or even the judge. That mission was always the same, to serve in a way that the criminal justice system is truly viewed as a place where there's justice for all, where there's fairness for all people who are impacted.
Joyette is a proven leader who we can count on to be firm but fair and never stray away from tackling the tough challenges that face our community.
When I talk about making the county safer through the work that we do as a prosecutor's office, it's that 360-degree approach to prosecution. As ministers of justice, we have to take that full circle approach to make sure our communities are safe. So it's not just the prosecution piece, but we are also talking about educating, going into our schools, going into our community, talking about prevention or opportunities for prevention in those same spaces. And then on the other side, is that restoration. Knowing that even though somebody has been impacted in a way that may take them to prison, that we are looking at what the next is going to be for them. So are we providing some sort of treatment for substance use disorders, mental health disorders? What got them in that position so that they're not reoffending and our recidivist numbers go down?
Joyette Holmes for Cobb County District Attorney. Paid for by Joyette Holmes for District Attorney.
Know someone with a drinking or drug problem? Learn how to get sober after we share these stories.
I was 35 with two beautiful children when my life and addiction started to spiral out of control. After my divorce, I went into a depression cycle and started drinking more often and using prescription drugs. After my second DWI and arrest, my ex-husband threatened to take our children away from me.
I was 17 when I became addicted to heroin and meth. I thought I could quit on my own, but I couldn't. It hit me when I was arrested.
Get sober now. Your private insurance may cover costs, and we'll get you here. It's simple. Just call Elite Rehab Placement right now. Please, don't wait. Your life matters to us. 800-958-2153. 800-958-2153. 800-958-2153. That's 800-958-2153.